11 people are now claiming they were abused as children at a Cape Cod summer camp in Sandwich. The victims include a man who says he was abused at Camp Good News by Charles DeVita, the camp employee who was found dead last week of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound.
On Friday, the camp's accreditation was revoked by the state, pending the abuse investigation. But Camp Good News was first cast into this downward spiral of bad news even earlier this year, when Senator Scott Brown alleged he was sexually abused while attending a Cape Cod camp as a child. He never named the camp, but Camp Good News confirmed that Brown was a camper there.
Well, all this might be leaving a lot of current Massachusetts campers and their parents wondering. Camp is a great experience for thousands of kids every year, so how do we keep it that way?
That's our talker today, summer camp in New England.
And we'd like your stories. Are you sending your kids to summer camp? Have you been to camp yourself? Camps should be safe, even an enchanting kind of place for people to, for kids to run wild and free for a few weeks. So are they? Or do you think more should be done?
And about that enchantment, camp is central to the experience of growing up in New England. It's all about personal growth and exploration away from your parents' worried gaze. Was there ever a time when you maybe worried that your first kiss or first crush on a camp counselor could be construed as something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
And we'll start first with the regulation question. To get a clearer picture of who's got what responsibility when it comes to camp oversight, Meghna spoke earlier today with Craig Sandler of the Statehouse News Service.
First questions first, are there regulations on the books at the state level regarding summer camps?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, the Department of Public Health conducts background checks on tens of thousands of not just workers, but volunteers. You really can't work in a summer camp anymore in Massachusetts without at least having a CORI, a criminal offender records information, background check made on you. And over the years, camps have been given increasingly broad leeway. In some cases, includes their juvenile history, because if you think about it, you know, a lot of counselors are so young, you have to raise the question of whether it's okay to look at their possible offender records as juvenile offenders.
Right, because they're teenagers, exactly.
Yeah.
Is it the State Department of Public Health that's actually doing the checks? Because I've read that the responsibility really falls to the local municipalities Department of Health.
The DPH sets the regulations under which the whole system runs.
But it's still it's still up to the local municipality to actually execute all those regulations.
Yes, that's right. And as a practical matter, oftentimes it can come down to the summer camps as well. It's not the case that state law requires a summer camp to fire you if offense X is found. And in fact, in some cases, I think you have the discretion to keep people on if they find something that's very borderline, which of course is true of most employers.
You know, I've been reading that camps have to go through all sorts of inspections that are required by the state. There are dozens of policies governing everything from how lost swimmers should be searched for to how campers themselves, if they need discipline, how that should happen, and obviously food. There's this hodgepodge of stuff that camps have to comply with. But at the state level, is there any sort of statewide licensing process that camps have to go through?
Not per se. You don't get issued a license to run a summer camp by the Department of Public Health. You know, the hodgepodge is really a result of the evolution of the interplay between news stories, particularly of abuse, a growing concern in general about kids and safety, and really the expanding interest of the Department of Public Health. So the first wave of camp regulation was, is the water safe and is the food safe? And that was the 1960s. Safety got more involved in it, you know, basically in the 70s. I know that when I started at the State House, this was like the late 80s, there were bills about summer camp safety. And that means, you know, how high are the fences, and background check for workers. But then in the late 90s, there was the Christopher Reardon case,
right,
which was a youth ministry camp worker who molested literally dozens and dozens and dozens of kids. And around that same time, there was just a movement. It was actually led by a group in Northampton. There was a movement to raise awareness of this, and people came forward in an organized way and talked about the abuse they had suffered at summer camp. Between that case and another case in Goshen, you know, the summer camp in Goshen, the issue just absolutely catapulted into the forefront. And Jane Swift, as governor, took it on as a really big issue and signed a massive summer camp Protection Law in 2002.
So, Craig, do you get any word at the State House right now that maybe there's another wave of regulation, or people are once again looking at what should be done to keep campers safe?
You know, in terms of policy, both the Health and Human Services Committee is likely to make a review of it. I'm sure that Public Safety and DPH will be looking at it, but I'm not aware of anything specific.
And last question, Craig, did you ever go to camp?
Yes, I did, and had a delightful time. In fact, I have to say, I went to camp in Goshen that was then horrifyingly 20 years later the subject of scandal. But I think, you know, it's so easy in this industry, both the industry of politics and the media, to forget how much health and happiness is actually out there. That's the mainstream. On the other hand, we don't necessarily write policy for the mainstream. We write policy to do the best job we can, you know, making it difficult for the extreme to take place, or at least reducing the odds.
Craig Sandler is the owner of State House News Service. I spoke with him a little earlier today. We are talking about summer camp in New England. And parents, are you worried now with the news from Camp Good News about safety of campers? Or do you think this is all being overblown? What are your memories of going to summer camp in New England? And what are your thoughts on things that you as parents or campers or camp organizers can do to make the summer camp experience as safe and enriching as possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I should make a note, a little earlier in this segment, I misspoke and I said the state revoked Camp Good News' accreditation. That's not true. The American Camp Association is the one that revoked that accreditation for Camp Good News out in Sandwich. Now, the man behind some of the legislative changes you heard Craig Sandler speak about is Northampton-based psychiatrist Richard Rice. He's co-director of the Camp Safety Project. Back in the 1990s, Rice encountered a number of kids who confided in him that they'd been abused at camp. So he wondered, were these isolated events? Rice sent a questionnaire to 350 police chiefs around Massachusetts asking if they'd had any reports of camp abuse in their jurisdictions. 38 replied, saying yes. So Dr. Rice took this information to the Massachusetts legislature, and his efforts in part led to the change you heard Craig Sandler talking about, that required background check for all camp employees. I spoke to Dr. Rice a little earlier today, and when I did, I asked him, you know, that sadly there will always be cases, we don't want them, but there will be, those that slip through the regulatory cracks. But still, camps have to operate under these really complicated webs of regulations now, and everyone's got to have that Corey background check. So really, Dr. Rice, I asked him, isn't that enough?
No, I would never. I think if you begin to think that, it's wishful thinking and you're inviting trouble.
Dr. Rice, if I may ask, everyone is concerned, especially all parents, are always concerned about the safety of their children, and they should be. But on the other hand, especially around the news coverage of cases of abuse and sexual abuse, it's easy to sort of flip over into hysteria. And I wonder, could we be verging in that direction when it comes to camp? I mean, it's not necessarily a breeding ground for predators.
Magda, I'm sorry to say, it is a breeding ground for predators because that's where the kids are. I think you have to know if that's where the kids are that it can happen. You're going to call that hysterical? Well, I'd rather be hysterical than hurt.
So then what would you advise parents today who, you know, have sent their kids to camp in the past and want to keep doing it? How would you advise that they, you know, they talk to their kids about the issue of potential abuse?
The first thing I would say is don't rely on somebody else, like Corey checks or background checks. The people who do those, the lawyers who do those, the first thing they will say to you is don't count on us. That is, this is not a foolproof test by any means. It only covers Massachusetts. It doesn't cover another state. It doesn't cover another country. So what I would say is, number one, be aware that abuse can happen at any camp any summer. Number two, it can happen to any child, including yours. You know, the more you're up front with the facts of life, the stronger your child's going to be.
That's Dr. Richard Rice, co-director of the Camp Safety Project. I spoke with him a little earlier today. We've got a couple other guests who I'm going to introduce in just a moment, but a lot of callers already want to join us, so let's welcome them in here. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and again, we're talking about camp safety and keeping summer camp safe and enchanting for Massachusetts children. Let's go to Bellingham. Maggie's on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I was sent to summer camp as a 14-year-old kid who was getting into some trouble, and it changed my life. I went on to direct that summer camp, and I guess the thing that I want to say is that, you know, we had very clear protocols about the situations that kids were allowed to be in with adults. We also had pre-camp training that made very, very clear to anybody that would be working at camp what those protocols and guidelines were. And we did dismiss staff people for, I won't even say they weren't physical things, but behavioral things, things that they said. There were very, very clear boundaries about what was and what wasn't appropriate behavior around the campers. And the other thing I want to say is, you know, I was a kid that was a gay kid, and to go to camp for the kids to get out of their town, to get beyond the confines of their daily life and explore and express. We can't lose the magic and importance of that. This is a very, very intense conversation about protocols, but to remember the beauty of how summer camp affects people. I'm not the person that I would have been. And that's because of summer camp.
Maggie, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is an issue we absolutely want to address. Sort of had to have both safety and enchantment and freedom, really, the sense of growth, exactly like you're talking about. We're going to do that in a minute. Thank you so much for your call, but let's take another call in here. Kate is on the line from Hingham. Welcome to Radio Boston, Kate.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. What's your thought today?
So my thought is that I have a son who has an autoimmune disease, and we found a camp here in New England that can accommodate him food-wise, because he'll never be able to go to a summer camp. He absolutely loves it. And last year, I actually volunteered as a counselor. And I have to say, I am incredibly impressed with their thought towards safety and background check.
Kate, did you yourself have to go through a background check?
Absolutely.
And
I did.
And yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, Kate. So you did, and I feel like, does that add to the cost or the complication of sending your son to such a camp?
No, absolutely not. And they were very open and forthcoming. Any question I had about safety, they were, you know, ready and willing to answer. They even gave me references to other people whose children had been to camp there. So, you know, my thing would be, you know, investigate, call people. Talk to the director, talk to several directors, because they should be able to reassure you. And you can get a sense from a director. You can get a sense very easily whether they really, you know, have their stuff together.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. And actually, I'm going to take your advice, and we're going to talk to a director right now. His name is Bill Hawk, and he's the director of Camp Watito in Beckett, Massachusetts. He's also vice president of the Massachusetts Camping Association and president of the Western Massachusetts Camp Directors Association. Bill Hawk, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
It's really great to have you. I'm also going to briefly introduce Leslie Paris. She is the author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp. She's an associate professor of American history at the University of British Columbia. Leslie Paris, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bill Hawk, first, a bunch of questions for you. I mean, you heard Craig Sandler earlier in the segment talk about the regulations that camps have to operate under. Can you tell me a little bit more detail of what it is that specifically that your summer camp, Camp Watito, and others that you work with, what do they do in order to comply with these regulations on who gets to work with children and teens?
Right. Well, as Craig said, originally camp regulations involved very basic health and sanitation issues. In the late 1990s, the question of background checks on staff became a very popular issue. And one of the things that happened, the Louise Woodward trial, which you probably would remember, happened to be going on at the time when this was all being formulated, and there was one initial level of regulations that were then expanded during the Swift administration in late 2002.
So, I mean, that was an expansion of rules that fell regarding, you know, child care, nannies and au pairs, and then it got expanded to summer camps, you're saying?
Summer camps. Initially, it just applied to camp employees who had direct contact with children, camp counselors, per se. And then the later expansion applied it to anyone who works in the camp.
So, I see.
So cooks and maintenance people and any sort of support staff have to be checked the same way that that camp counselors do. Now, in Massachusetts, well, first of all, we were the first state to have these sort of background requirements. We do a CORI check on all our employees.
But the CORI, I'm sorry to interrupt, Bill, but the CORI only, as you know, it only applies to residents of Massachusetts who committed crimes here.
That is correct. And in addition to the CORI, we do a background check on all of our staff people in their home jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So if a counselor is coming from Maryland, or if a counselor is coming from South Carolina, or if they're coming from England or Australia, we're doing a background check on them in their home jurisdiction as well. And then the final piece of it also is a sexual offender registry check, which we do both through the Massachusetts SORI system and through the national registry as well.
Got it. So, I mean, Bill, you've got one of the great things. I was so delighted to have you on the show is that not only are you currently the director of Camp Watito, but you've got a long family history as well there. I believe the camp is it 75 years old?
This will be our 75th anniversary summer, and it's the 52nd year that our family has owned the camp.
And your father was director before you.
That's correct.
So you've
my mother is still co-director with me.
Oh, she is. Okay, so you've got this long personal history, and you've seen how sort of parents and their expectations and the things that you have to do to operate a summer camp have changed over time. So, I mean, have things changed at Watito in terms of the kids' experience there? I mean, when they come there, do they still feel as free and able to grow personally as possible, or do they come with this fear where parents are saying, "Watch out! Who knows what's going to happen?"
No. I think the fear that you speak of is shaped by outside events. What goes on in camp, and camp really is a very insulated world unto itself, is still very much the way it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Once camp gets into full swing and we're into our activities and the kids are reunited with their friends and they've made new friends, they really are kind of in their own little zone of safety, so to speak, where they're not afraid. I think everyone in camp knows each other and trusts each other and feels safe around each other, so much so that when we send a group of children on a trip, a field trip, where they're going out of camp, we have to give them a special reminder talk about what it's like to go out back to the real world.
Yeah. We are talking about summer camp and keeping it special and keeping it safe in the lives of Massachusetts young people. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Leslie Paris, you're author of Children's Nature, The Rise of American Summer Camp. And you were hearing Bill Hawk just now talk about, the long history of summer camps, just, you know, even in his own family. But interestingly, in your book, I read that you say that things really changed in terms of when people started worrying about various aspects of safety in camps after World War II. Now, why is that?
Well, in terms of children's sexual safety, before World War II, most camps were single sex, and the assumption, whether it was correct or not, was that there would not be sexual abuse at summer camps in single-sex environments. This was not actually the case, but the assumption was that only when camps became co-ed would camp leaders and staff have to be more concerned about questions of children's sexual safety.
I see. Let's take a call here. Mike is calling from Concord. Welcome to Radio Boston, Mike.
Thank you. Two quick points. One, I went to camp as a child and loved it. It was wonderful, and went a number of years, and I can't say enough good things. I will say, in raising my own children, that I don't think any parent can count on the laws or screening to protect their kids. There are too many pedophiles. They go where the kids are. So whether it's camp, church groups, Boy Scouts, or whatever, you basically should not let your child go somewhere and be alone until they're old enough to, you know, be vocal and stand up for themselves and yell and scream and fight if anything goes wrong.
Mm.
So I think all the talk of screening and CORI and, you know, I mean, fine, but I think at the end of the day, the only real protection is you don't let your child be alone until they're old enough and mature enough to articulate and yell and scream and not acquiesce.
Mike, how old is that in your mind?
I think it varies by child, but I would guess somewhere between 10 and 14. I know in my kid's case it was more towards the 10 area, but, you know, to me at 10 they all seemed like they thought they were 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when a child won't let people push them around, and as a parent, you know, you'll see this in school. Did they, you know, in elementary school, did they stick up for themselves on the playground? I mean, so there's no perfection here, and there's no easy solution. But counting on screening or laws or good intentions is not enough.
Got it. Mike, Mike, thank you so much for your call. Bill Hawk, let me ask you, in what ages of campers do you have out there at Camp Watito?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat that again?
I was wondering, what age range of campers do you have at Camp Watito?
Well, our campers start out at 7
mm-hmm.
and go up to 16.
So what kind of training, I mean, we heard Mike, just the caller Mike, say that he thinks that parents shouldn't send their kids away until they've reached an age, and it can vary, of when, you know, they're basically able to stand up for themselves and say, what's happening to me is wrong. But I wonder if I can flip that over and ask you, what kind of training do camp counselors themselves get in terms of, you know, interacting or watching out for what happens with, say, younger campers versus older campers?
Well, all camps run some sort of a pre-camp orientation program, usually somewhere between 5 to 7 days prior to the opening of camp. And this issue of camper safety has really become the centerpiece of staff orientations everywhere. I mean, some camps even bring in outside speakers who speak on this subject, you know, as part of their regular course of business to help educate staff members about how to behave around kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question, you know, the last caller mentioned something about, you know, kids not being alone.
I'm sorry, I lost the picture.
The thing is that, you know, in camps you have overlapping levels of supervision, and that's the key, that kids are never really in a position where they're alone, because there's always more than one staff person around. So someone is always watching someone else.
Right.
See? And in that way you minimize the risk. But I also think that there is something to be said for the screening process, not so much the background, the criminal background check part, but really trying to get to know who your staff are before you bring them into camp.
Yeah. You know, Leslie Paris, if I may ask you, Adam and I were sort of talking at the very beginning of this segment, and then actually one of our first callers mentioned this as well, about the magic and the enchantment and the really sort of unique experience that young people have going to camp, and especially in New England, where so many children do experience it. And part of that magic, you know, is that maybe sometimes it's a place where you have your first romantic experience, your first kiss, you know, where you first maybe fall in love with even a camp counselor, and it's just a crush. I mean, Leslie, hasn't that always been part of the camp experience?
Absolutely, it has been. And in my own research and in interviews with many former campers from the early 20th century onward, I found that that was often part of the magic of camp, a sexual awakening or exploration up to some degree. I think there's a difference here that's important between sexual coercion, mm-hmm. in which a child or adolescent is coerced or bullied or threatened into being sexually active, and sexual experimentation that's desired by both parties.
Absolutely. I mean, and I don't think anyone out there would disagree that, you know, criminal abuse of any kind is an absolutely terrible and abhorrent thing. But Bill Hawk, I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is that what about in those cases where, I mean, I understand the law in Massachusetts says that counselors have to be at least 3 years older than the campers that they're overseeing. But there seems to be some kind of gray area there. I mean, crushes on counselors, you know, first kisses, et cetera. How do you, as a camp director, navigate that? You don't want to tamp down on a camper's personal growth, but at the same time, you know, there's this sense that maybe some what begins as something innocent may not be.
Well, you have to have some reasonable boundaries that are sketched out for everyone at the beginning. And I think that as part of the orientation of staff, you have to impress upon young counselors that their role in camp is very different from the role of the teenage campers, and that they can be friends with them and they can have supportive, friendly relationships with them, but that you can't have that kind of physical contact between teenagers, you know, where one is a staff member and one is a camper. That you just, people just have to understand that is part of the boundaries of living within summer camp.
Well, Bill Hawk, director of Camp Watito in Beckett, Massachusetts, and vice president of the Massachusetts Camping Association, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Leslie Paris, author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp, and an associate professor of American history at the University of British Columbia, thank you so much for joining us as well.
It was my pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow on Radio Boston, I don't know about you, Magna, but when I think about what I want to do with my life, separating plastic number 2 from plastic number 5 doesn't rocket to the top of my list.
It's maybe number 2 on my list.
But in Boston and Cambridge and dozens of other local municipalities, you can just put it all in the same recycling bin now. So what's everybody's excuse for not doing it? We'll look into why a huge percentage of recyclables ends up in the landfill tomorrow on Radio Boston.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from theangle@boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. Join us again then for more Radio Boston.